generally happens after chapel and at the beginning of a convocation reminds me of the title of a book. It is a book that is very unpopular in Arab territory of the Middle East, we were told yesterday. The title of the book is Exodus. And we were told also that the very name Israel, for example, is one that has to be expunged from some of the religious literature of the Christian church in the Middle East. There hasn't been very much time to publicize the appearance of these two emissaries from the Middle East, and this is, of course, the reason why there is such a small attendance this morning. However, it appears to me that what they have to say is of such significance that at least those who are in a position to attend will want to know about it, will want to keep abreast of and alert to significant recent developments on the mission front of our church. And therefore, we're very glad and proud to introduce to you missionary Edward Azzam from the Middle East, who is with us this morning, and we'll call on him for a few words later. And then missionary Walter Bott, and I'll ask him to make his Middle East report as he's been making it these past few days to top mission representatives of our church.
Thank you. Brothers in Christ, we are very grateful for this opportunity to present also to you some of our concerns that we have had as we have traveled through the Middle East. This is a very remarkable country of many sights and sounds and odors, and is a land which has certainly, which deserves the attention of our church. The last time I spoke in this auditorium, in 1945, the attendance was somewhat similar. You need not apologize, President Anker. I was delivering my senior sermon, and Dr. Summer was sitting in the place where Pastor Azzam is now sitting, and my distinguished classmates, among whom was also Professor Fred Danker, were in the back row, all the way in the back row, reading their newspapers, except for Professor Danker, who was reading Kittle. So the situation is very similar and very ordinary, quite acceptable. I should begin with at least one Arabic joke, and the only one I can think of at this moment is, as I look over the audience, I recognize a number of faces, and so as one Arab said to the other, "I can't remember your name, but the fez is familiar." That probably comes out of a Reader's Digest, but the Arabs think it's one of theirs. The particular subject I would like to speak to you is one is called encounter. During the past year and a half, 2 years and a half actually, the Lutheran Church of the Missouri Synod entered the Middle East with the intent of establishing a mission program. After a few months in that area, it became rather obvious that missions are not easily established in the 20th century, and certainly not in the Arabic world. The era of colonialism is fortunately over, and this also applies to religious colonialism. And any type of mission must be planned very, very carefully and extremely well. And so the church wisely suggested that our mission to the Middle East be one of survey and of exploration. It has therefore been our privilege during the past year particularly to visit most of the countries of the Middle East into which one can gain entry. Just to remind you of where the Middle East was, I didn't know when I went. The Middle East is this remarkable bridge land between Africa, Europe, and Asia. It includes these fascinating countries, Syria, Lebanon,
Jordan, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, Iraq, sometimes Iran, Saudi Arabia, the less known areas as Muscat, Qatar, Bahrain, Dahran, Yemen, and of course also Egypt, the Sudan, Ethiopia, which is in a class by itself, and the Somali Republic, barely 2 years old now. Sometimes Turkey is included, and the definition varies according to your particular choice. But in this area, we encountered many things. First, of course, we encountered the Arab, this remarkable person who has a tremendous ability for individualism. He is not united, even though he has been working at this for some 500 years. And recently, one author writing on the subject said, "The only time that the Arab will ever unite is when he unites against someone who is trying to unite him." I think this is a rather good definition. And this has been true for some 500, 600 years. And the individualism of the Arab is a remarkable thing. It permits the Arab service or taxi driver in Beirut to drive on the sidewalk if necessary to avoid the traffic. It allows the City Planning Commission of Beirut to have a one-way street with streetcars running in two directions. It allows almost anything. It is a planned anarchy. And it encourages the businessmen to move the government buildings out of the middle of the city because they interfere with business. And it allows many other things. And this is perhaps what makes it so tremendously fascinating. The Arab speaks the Arabic language, a language which has not changed a great deal, if at all, in the past 1,000 years, a language which is rather hard on Western throats and for Western tongues, but it's an interesting language nevertheless. And to hear a Friday sermon from the mosque by a religious leader, a sheikh or imam, is a kind of a rare treat, even if you can't understand it. There's something magnificent about the sound of Arabic when it is spoken by an expert. But it grates on your ears and annoys all your better sensitivities when you hear the women in the neighborhood talk it. It just doesn't sound right. But here's the language of Allah, of God, and the language which cannot be changed. And the Quran cannot be changed, therefore. Nor can the Quran ever be studied properly, scientifically, the way it perhaps ought to be studied. Nevertheless, these Arabic people were the ones that we met. They differ from Egypt to Iraq, from Lebanon. The Lebanese prefer to be called crafty Phoenicians, a title they well deserve. And the Saudis, the Bedouins, the Fellaheen, and all the others. These are remarkable people, and it was well to encounter them for the first time in the history of our church, or in the history of the Lutheran Church of America, a Lutheran mission came to the Arabs. It was somewhat surprising to us. I
suspect that we did not immediately establish a rather large and sizable congregation, because after all, we were coming now. And for many centuries, none of us had been there, and it was a disappointment that the Arabs did not turn to Lutheranism wholesale. But it didn't happen, and this particular story does not have the happy end for which the Germans criticize the Americans so much. But nevertheless, this was a good encounter, because we found ourselves in touch with a tough situation, a really hard situation, and compelled us to think, and to think hard about many, many things. And so we had another encounter, and this encounter was with the ancient churches. These also are well represented in all their color and multiplicity in the Arab world. These were people we had rarely heard about, and in my day at the seminary at least, we barely studied them. But I think they deserve a lot of attention. Here are churches which look a little bit like museums, are as dusty as some, and which smell very much like ancient churches, and which are fabulously interesting, but which seem to be more dead than alive. And yet, as one examines this particular structure of these churches, one begins to realize that these churches deserve at least a kind of a compliment instead of always being wrapped. They manage to stay alive, in a sense, during many, many years of opposition and persecution and attempts at practical annihilation. So you take off your hats to the Armenians and the Nestorians and the Monophysites and all the others, the Maronites, for just being there. This is to their credit. They managed to stay there all these years in spite of the tremendous opposition of Islam and the Arabic world. On the other hand, the very fact that they spend most of the time trimming their lamps and adjusting their candles and reciting their ancient rituals, and often finding themselves somewhat lost as to just how do you read Aramaic. One occasion I was in the chapel of St. John Mark in Jerusalem, and the young priest who was to read to us John 14 couldn't find it because he didn't quite know how John was spelled in Aramaic. But nevertheless, these folks are there, they have survived, and they have maintained a kind of a witness, and they have held forth Christ before these people. Not very well, not very effectually. They're very much afraid of encounter with the Muslim world because it might upset the working arrangement, which is a very delicate thing. And they would rather stay alive than be persecuted once again. But these people deserve our attention and our study. And our church's mission to the Middle East, I think, has suggested at least this much, that the Christian church ought to become far more involved in thinking about these ancient churches. The Anglican church feels that it has a witness and a mission to these people, and somewhat successfully has worked with them and encouraged them, and in a sense, here and there, revived them. Another interesting aspect of the ancient churches is this, that in recent years, as some of them have become involved in World Council of Church discussions, they have seen Protestantism in its better forms, and they have taken a second look and a better look, and I suspect that this contact may help these churches considerably. This will not happen overnight, of course, but in the course of some decades, perhaps another century or two, some good will come from these contacts, suggesting perhaps to us this thought that isolationism is not necessarily a good thing,
You may not be preserving the right thing. You may be preserving lamps and rituals and liturgies, but you may be losing the life. And so as the churches and the World Council establish contact, we suspect that some good things will come forth. Some have already come out of this. We sat in the office of Father Sarkissian, the dean of the Armenian Seminary in Antilias, Lebanon, one of the better seminaries of the Orthodox churches, some say the best. And here we found a highly intelligent man, Oxford trained, conducting his school in the best fashion and urging his students to read some current books, because the World Council of Churches had supplied them with some excellent material. It may be of interest to those who are looking for Doctor of Divinity degrees. It is possible at this seminary to get one in 3 years after high school. Those who are having a hard time, they want to try the school. But this encounter is a good one, and this attempt to meet with these people. They need help. They're not asking for it too loudly. They're too proud. They've had too long a history. They're too ancient. But they recognize their failings, and the younger men particularly are concerned about contacts with the living Church of Jesus Christ. They still have the problem of nationalism. Too many of them are trying to preserve their own particular type of religion because it represents a particular race or a tribe or a language. This is certainly true of the Armenians. But there's a contact, and the contact is an important one for us as well as for other churches. The other encounter that I would like to speak of is the encounter with Protestant missions. Too often we as a church enter an area assuming somehow or other that no one has ever preached the gospel there before. But we discover that the gospel had been preached not only by the ancient churches, but also by Protestants since 1820, when some Americans came into the Middle East and began a program of missions. Others had followed them. The Presbyterians came first, the Congregationalists, and later on the Dutch Reformed, and a couple of years ago, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And as we encountered these missions, we recognized the tremendous problems that these people had had in the course of centuries, in the course of decades. So I may cite just one example. In Aden, which is somewhat in the news even in America these days, very much in the news in the Middle East and also in the British Empire, because this is one of the last of the colonies and it is beginning to totter a bit. In Aden, the Scotch Presbyterians came in 1885 with Jan Keith Falconer, established a hospital and a chapel, and worked very hard and very well. By 1930, they had gained their first convert 45 years later. These Danish Lutherans came to Aden in 1904. Last year, in the beginning of January, the Danish Lutherans and the Scotch Presbyterians joined, along with the Sudan Interior Mission and the Red Sea Mission, to organize the Church of South Arabia. They now count 10 members, all of them together. Unfortunately, schism rent this new church asunder almost immediately, and the Sudan Interior people and the Red Sea people left, and the Scotch Presbyterians and the Danish Lutherans remain. This is a remarkable mission. Amazing work, amazing devotion and loyalty. and one of the best and most successful missions in the entire Arab world. This was something of a surprise to us, because counting the congregations around the Persian Gulf and in the Arabic world, congregations which really consist of converts from Islam to Christianity, you add up about 200 souls. This is the result of some 140 years of work in about 5 different congregations. This is not very much to show for several hundred missionaries, an immense program of hospitals, institutions, schools, and so on. But this is a witness. This is a tremendous witness. And one wonders what the Arab world would be like today if it were not for the existence and presence of these churches of Jesus Christ, because they're holding forth the word of life and proclaiming Christ crucified very effectively. But there are no results. There are no numbers. There are no statistics. And this is a kind of a good thing. It makes statistically minded people and persons and churches aware all of a sudden that the church is not just a matter of numbers, and that mission work is not necessarily always successful as we count success. In our contact with these Protestant missions, we learned a good many things, and perhaps above all, that these are devout, dedicated Christians who are working out of love for God and Christ and for these, their fellow men in the Arab world. They're not here to merely for the sake of social improvement, but they are there to preach the gospel of Christ. This is good to know and good to recognize. At the same time, this presents for us at least a problem due to the fact that the Muslim world is largely closed, if not entirely, to new missions. We soon had to come to grips with the problem of how do you establish a church? And before we knew it, we had invitations from the United Church of Iraq, the Church of South Arabia and Aden, and the Evangelical Lutherans of Jordan, a brand new church, to work with them. We began to realize our dilemma. We cannot work on our own because this can no longer be done. New churches cannot enter into these lands. Rather, they are being expelled. We were in Khartoum in the Sudan some weeks before Christmas. The week before we came there, 8 missionary families were expelled by the government because their services were no longer necessary to the Sudanese government. The week after we left, 14 more were expelled for the same reason. This is the kind of a world that the Middle East is. In Iraq, my half-year-old American newspapers were confiscated because they needed to be censored, and Americans are not welcome with or without newspapers. The American ambassador was recalled at the request of the Iraqi government some months ago and has not yet returned. There's no room for missions there, because the government wants none. And so these invitations take on a kind of a new meaning. How do you preach the gospel of Christ in a world which will not let the Lutheran Church become established? What do you do, and I don't have the answers, what do you do when a church of Aden, for example, of South Arabia, Presbyterian and Lutheran, originally, now merged to form one church of South Arabia, what do you do when such a church invites you to share with them in the witness to the Muslim, particularly when this is perhaps the finest mission in the entire Middle East? How do you handle an invitation like this? How about all of our principles and rules of thumb of unionism and fellowship, just how do you handle them in that case? It's a good question. And yesterday, the Board for World Missions took rather significant action when they referred some of these problems to the Theological Commission of our church. Because we need to grapple with this kind of thing. We can't ignore these. We can't continue to build up our own little colonies throughout the world. Because after all, we are here to build the Church of Jesus Christ, and we are his ambassadors and his witnesses. But the problems are tough, and they're real, and they cause us to think, and this is good. So the encounter with Protestantism in the Middle East and Protestant missions has been a very good one. Then there is another encounter. This, of course, is the encounter with Islam itself. Too often we think of Islam or Mohammedanism, as it is still called, unfortunately, by some, that this is a kind of an ancient religion, and as people drive modern cars and wear Western clothing, that this will also kind of pass away. This, of course, is not true. Islam is a very vital, dynamic religion. It meets the needs not only of the Bedouin and the Fellaheen, the farmer in Egypt. It also meets the needs of many highly educated, cultured Arabs. It seems to meet the needs anyhow. But it is their religion. And this is a growing thing. It is not fading away. It is not dead on its feet. It has more vitality than much of the Orthodox churches. It has a missionary zeal. And someone has suggested, and a good scholar, that before the end of this century, all of Africa will be Muslim. And this is entirely possible, because the best statistics seem to indicate that the conversion of Muslims is going on apace in Africa at the rate of 10 to Islam over against 1 to Christianity. This is a real thing. And now the World Council of Churches has established a special study project of Islam in Africa. How can the church meet this particular threat? What can we do? What was wrong with the kind of work we did in the past? Why are the Christians tumbling into Islam? Not just the pagans in Africa, but the converted Christians, so-called. What did we do wrong? And this encounter, again, would suggest to us that we re-examine our missionary methods, particularly this one, the problem of extracting an individual from his community. Because this seems to be the difficulty. When you take out just one from his community and then draw him into another community which may not be quite ready to really accept him, and he loses his contact with his former community, what about this particular kind of a situation? We don't know the answers, of course, neither do many other much wiser people, but this is something to think about. And in the relationship to Islam, this is a particular problem. When a Muslim becomes a Christian, and this happens very, very rarely, he has given up his citizenship. In Turkey, for example, a Christian who happens to be a Turk is not a Turk. He is considered a resident of Turkey holding a Turkish passport, but he's not a Turk. And in most areas, an Arab is a Muslim. There are some Christians who live in Arabic countries, but they're not real Arabs in the mind of many. And this community of Arabs is a tightly knit community, and you can't pull people out of the community. It still happens that someone dares to make the change. and then there's still bloodshed. We read about it in our papers now. This is not something out of the Middle Ages. How does a church handle this kind of a problem? And here, my colleague Pastor Zahm and I had the wonderful opportunities to sit at the feet of Dr. Kenneth Cragg and Dr. Hendrik Kramer, two of the great missionaries of our time and great scholars as well. And we were reminded that this kind, Dr. Kramer suggested, is not driven out except by fasting and prayer. And by fasting, he suggested, this meant the intense application of the individual to the problem, meaning also a good deal of study. Islam is not driven out easily. But this is going to take a great deal of study. And so men like Dr. Kramer and Dr. Cragg are suggesting that the church must first study this matter. Because when the church first came to the Middle East 140 years ago, they soon found themselves up against a stone wall and they gave up converting Muslims. And they simply extracted a few people from the Orthodox communities. And almost all the Protestant churches existing in the Middle East today are really made up of former members of the Orthodox churches. Someone has suggested the figure is about 99%. These are not Muslims who became Christians, but rather members of the Orthodox churches who, for one reason or another, often attracted by material advantages, joined the newer Protestant churches. In some areas, they were called the Congregation of the Shillings, because the shilling was given out to those who came when the bell rang. Or as Pastor Zahm observed in the meeting yesterday, there's a little Arabic word which in effect says, English me. That means, do to me what the nice English people do when they ask me to come to church, give me something. The church has perhaps not always done its work too well. But here we are up against this problem of how do you reach a Muslim for Christ? And what do you do when you've reached him? For this is a truth, a sad truth, that when a Muslim does accept Christianity, the Christian churches in the Middle East today will not accept him. And this is, of course, very unfortunate, because they don't trust him. They reject him. Where does a man go? What do you do with them? Well, these, brothers, are some of the problems which our Lutheran mission to the Middle East has encountered. This has been our contact. We can't bring back any impressive statistics, but perhaps we have become somewhat wiser. And our church, our Board for World Missions yesterday, took note of these particular difficulties, and we believe is entering upon a significant approach to the whole Muslim problem, not only in the Middle East but elsewhere, and that it has appointed now a Muslim Mission Study Council, to approach this with a great deal of intelligence and concern. For these 450 million people throughout the world, 125 of them being in the Arabic world, these are our brothers, and they too need the gospel. They know the name of Christ, but they do not know his love. They do not accept his death and his atonement, and they need Christ, as we all do. Brother Banker, this is as much as...
Thank you very much, Pastor Bach. I'm sure all of us are glad that we came and had a chance to encounter, through you, some of these very real and living problems that confront our church on its mission frontiers. And now we're glad that we have with us Pastor Edward Azam, too. You referred to the Phoenicians a moment ago, and when I was at the very hospitable home of Pastor Azam in Lebanon a little over a year ago, he told me that the little tot in Lebanon, he asked him, how much is 2 plus 2? Come back with the swift answer, am I buying or selling? It was very good to have on our team a Phoenician, after Edward is on.
I'm sure if you go to a double feature, you don't try to be too wet.
Usual history, they came to us out of the Assembly of God, and at one time had an evangelist who was working for the Lutheran Church and the Pentecostal Church at the same time. So we do not really think of them as congregations of converts. Work beyond this is concerned, Pastor Zahm and I are the only representatives of our church in that part of the world. This may be one reason for our ineffectiveness, but our mission a year ago was declared an exploratory mission. I think this is a very wise approach, and so we explored. We traveled throughout the Middle East. We were in most of the countries of that area, but as far as having converts, we don't know of any. But we have served members of these two little congregations, which total perhaps 25 communicants and some 25 baptized members, some 10 communicants. But these came to us in a somewhat irregular way and are not to be counted strictly as mission congregations, because these folks were Christians before. In fact, on Easter, they go to what they call their church, the Orthodox Church, because due to the fact that we are not registered, we cannot bury them or marry them, and even baptism presents some problems, because baptism is, at least in part, a way of identifying yourself and your community as a Christian. A Christian is a political designation, and if you want to vote, they do some voting occasionally in the Middle East. If you want to vote, you must be registered, and baptism is at least in part a kind of a registration.
Thank you. There was another hand over on this side. Dean Zeigler.
Yes. The Lutheran Hour is one of our programs, and we had the unfortunate... We had a difficulty with this program some time ago, because the speaker on the Lutheran Hour was a man who was very much against the Lutherans. But you have these problems in the mission field from time to time. But currently, we are very glad to have, as a Lutheran Hour speaker, a man by the name of Reverend Gabriel Zabani, an Arab, who speaks German. This is a very interesting thing, because he was trained in Neuendettelsau, the school which produced which Leuer developed, and I think Springfield history goes back to Neuendettelsau. But this man is our speaker. You cannot buy radio time in the Middle East. We have time on Radio Beirut by an arrangement which dates back some 10 years now. This was a very good arrangement, and we are still on this program. But we're not allowed to identify it other than as the Lutheran Hour. We cannot send out any kind of gifts such as flower seeds or anything of that sort. So the result is that we've never had had any mail in response to the Lutheran Hour. But we do broadcast also through another station in Liberia, Monrovia, Liberia, the station called ELWA, which is an SIM, Sudan Interior Station. We are on this station because we promise not to recommend either smoking or drinking on our broadcast. This has not been a problem with us, really. But this is a good opportunity, and this broadcast is beamed into the Middle East every day. And the Lutheran Hour broadcast, these Arabic tapes which we produce in Beirut, go out over this station. And we do get some mail in response to this, approximately perhaps 60 letters a year, not a day. But there's a new project, and a very significant one, the so-called Radio Voice of the Gospel in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, where the Lutheran World Federation, and supported in part by our own Lutheran Hour here in America, has erected a magnificent station. We were there just before Christmas. One of the finest stations, I'm sure, in the entire Middle East, if not in all of Asia, which will be a voice of the gospel, preaching the gospel, and also offering to people in that area other information, such as news, which is hard to come by in the Middle East, that is reliable news. There are many, many news releases published by dictators and so on, but the real news is a very, very touchy problem. But this will come out of there, as well as information on some of the health and sanitation. But primarily, this will be a radio voice of the gospel. These other programs are included because the gospel is always total, and it affects all of life. This station will be dedicated February 26th, and I think will be a highly significant addition to the radio message in the Middle East. On this station, the Lutheran Hour will also be broadcast, and there will be some opportunity to promote our correspondence course. But this is very good. Yes.
Could you say a word about that? I think, how many people do you have actively engaged in this correspondence course, which is promoted by your radio ministry?
Our radio ministry has promoted the correspondence course since 1952. At that time, it was conducted as a kind of a private venture subsidized by Lutherans here in St. Louis. A very good beginning that was. And we now have some 2,500 regular students, that is those who continue to send in their lessons. And this program reaches, of course, mostly Christians, but we estimate 5, 6, or 7% of these people are Muslim. So there is a contact there. Our particular problem is this, that if finally the contact must be more than a radio contact or more than a lesson contact, there must be a referral to a congregation. And here another question. Since we have no churches of any kind in most of these areas, except in Jordan, where they happen to be Lutherans of the German persuasion, of the German church sponsored, can we in good conscience refer writers, correspondence course people to the existing churches? Well, we do, and my conscience is satisfied at the moment anyhow. But this is another one of the questions and difficulties in this area.
Question back there.
Traveling. The past year, this was our assignment. Studying Islam, studying the Middle East, contacting missions of various sorts, and writing a report. We just submitted a 100-page report, or almost that, to the board, and this is why we are here. And out of this discussion, they developed certain procedures and recommendations. But most of the missions in the Middle East, they also travel too, but not as much as we do. Lutherans are notoriously wealthy, and particularly our synod, so we travel a great deal more than they. But these people maintain hospitals and schools. This is one of the few opportunities you have for witness. This is another problem, Brother Danker, the problem of institutionalism in missions. How valid is an institution in missions, a hospital? What about particularly when you cannot give a verbal witness? In the Christian schools maintained by Christian money, the lecture in religion or the class in religion always begins with this statement. This is a law. Will all Muslims please leave the room? What do you do in a situation like this? When you're teaching religion and you're trying to be witnessing to the Muslim, and then you ask him to leave because the government insists on this particular procedure. What kind of a witness is this?
Thank you. May I say that the travels of these men have been eminently worthwhile and money, some of the best money we've spent. Their report is one of the finest which the Board of World Missions has ever received. I believe responsible officials in our church body, the Board of World Missions level, and certainly also in due course at the Board of Directors level, will have a better understanding of the problems involved in the encounter with Islam in the Middle East than we've ever had before as a result of the efforts that these men have made. But there's time for one more quick question or comment. Up here. Yes, please.
Yes, this is one of the unfortunate aspects, because for many, many centuries, the Christians and the Muslims have lived in a state of cold war. Islam is not merely a religion, it is a way of life, it is a church state, not just a state church. And Christians, again, live in their own little world, their own community. And these communities do not mix. There are many, many factors involved. The Crusades are important in this. The Crusades were political and religious, and so was the movement of Islam, political and religious. And this encounter still bears its fruits. The Crusades happened like about yesterday as far as the Middle East is concerned. When we think of the Civil War, we think of something which happened long ago. The Crusades did not happen very long ago in the Middle East. And this tremendous fanatical violence, opposition, and hatred still exists. No one trusts a Muslim, none of the Christians, because in every instance, a Christian is in a tremendous minority. Lebanon is the exception. There it is, so-called 50-50, half Muslim, half Christian. Whereas in most of the countries, the percentage of Christians is 1% or 2%, perhaps 10% if it's high. The Christian's always in the minority. And he does not want to lose his members. He does lose them to Islam, whereas rarely does a Muslim become a Christian. There are some notable exceptions. We spoke to one of them, Bishop Hassan Dehkani Tufti, the bishop of the Anglican Church in Iran. This man was a Muslim and is now an Anglican bishop, but he did have a Christian mother. Nevertheless, this man's little book called Design of My World is eminently worthwhile reading, a book of some 60 pages. We had a wonderful meeting with this rather young person, energetic leader of his people. He represents the finest in Christianity in the Middle East. He's not an Arab, unfortunately. He's an Iranian, a Persian. But this is an interesting example. But his book is good, Design of My World.
Thank you very much. And I'm sure that all of us will want to respond with you to the challenges posed by your encounter, the challenge to grapple through the theological problems posed by these concrete questions, and the challenge to pray and to wrestle and to agonize. Thank you.
Well, thank you.